If you follow things like I am required to do as part in the capacity of host of this radio program, if you follow things in the news, you might have been noticing a trend over about the last 3 or 4 years. And that trend has been a more vocal, more organized, and I think more courageous, not in a morally positive sense, but bolder, I should say, a bolder attempt to normalize homosexuality. You've noticed it. Everyone has noticed it. Case in point, turn on your television anytime during prime time, generally speaking on the sitcom, but now it's making its way into the later evening police dramas and whatnot. There seems to be the obligatory, one might even say token, homosexual character, especially in the sitcoms. Some of them, I'm thinking in particular of Will and Grace, basically, that's the premise for the entire system of comedy that's laid out in that half-hour sitcom. It basically is the fodder for most of the jokes. This is nothing new, but it is bolder, it is stronger, it is more vocal and more organized today. Then there is the issue of same-sex unions. Then there is the issue of what people view as archaic sodomy laws in various states. And, of late, gay adoption. We're going to talk about gay adoption with Joe Dallas during the first 25 minutes of this last hour of Issues, Etc. Joe Dallas is founder of Genesis Counseling, based in Tustin, California, author of the books Desires in Conflict and A Strong Delusion. He's also written an article in a recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled What About Rosie? If you'd like to join us, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we finished our conversation with Joe, we will have a half hour of open lines, the last half hour of the program. We'll hear from the president, not personally, of course, but via tape, his State of the Union address in parts. Get your reaction. I'll have a little reaction of my own as well. Joe Dallas, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Todd, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Joe, before we talk about Rosie in particular, how would you size up the national movement, if we can call it that, for gay adoption?
I would use, Todd, pretty much the same words you used. Well organized, aggressive. I would throw in relentless. And I think it is a movement that is appealing more to emotion than logic. In fact, the article you mentioned, which I wrote for the Christian Research Journal, largely centered on Rosie O'Donnell, because Rosie O'Donnell is a very popular cultural figure. And so when people who are likable or well-known take a position, unfortunately, many people adopt that position as their own just because a celebrity has adopted it, not because they've thought it through. So it's a movement that is well-orchestrated, very aggressive, and appeals, I think, more to emotion than to common sense.
Where is the movement? Where is the battle line for this movement? Where is the battle being engaged and waged?
It is being waged in so many parts of the culture and the church, Todd, that at any given time you'll see it rearing its head in one area particularly, but it's always there in others. I think it's fair to say in every aspect of academia, law, psychology, and religion, you will find a very visible movement to normalize homosexuality. And ultimately, normalization is the first part of the goal, but only the first. The second is basically the eradication of any opposing viewpoints. And those two go hand in hand.
And these opposing viewpoints are viewed as manifesting themselves in things like Florida laws against same-sex couples adopting children.
Well, certainly Florida laws, or individual spokespersons who simply take a conservative viewpoint, or churches that uphold a biblical standard, or synagogues or mosques for that matter. So really anywhere where you see either an individual or people who do not approve of homosexuality, you'll see a clash, because the ultimate goal is basically for a uniform opinion in America on this issue.
I mentioned Will and Grace before as a sitcom and one of these sitcoms that has taken a lot of heat and it still gives a lot of heat, too, on the issue of normalizing homosexuality. One of the things that strikes me in the few episodes I have seen of this is that Will and Grace seem to exist in a universe where homosexuality is completely accepted, where there is no quote-unquote homophobia.
That's the idea, Todd, because the more that the media presents us with that kind of a world, the more we come to believe that that's probably how the world is. So if we object to homosexuality, we must be the oddballs, because in the world television shows us and in the world the films show us, homosexuality is generally accepted, except, of course, by stupid, bigoted Neanderthals like me. So that pretty much gives you the sense that, gee, I must be the only person in the country who feels that homosexuality is abnormal. And what does that do? Of course, it intimidates.
Related to this, and related to Rosie, an observation. I remember watching Rosie O'Donnell's morning time show occasionally with my wife. She thought it was nice, and during the summer months when she's not teaching, she was watching it. And I always asserted, Rosie is a lesbian. I said, she seems to fit the mold. I mean, here I am, Mr. Stereotype. She seems to fit the mold to me. But I would always assert, kind of tongue-in-cheek, she's a lesbian. My wife would object, and then later, of course, it came out that she was, in fact, a lesbian. But Rosie was not formally outed, and she didn't formally out herself. It was almost like an emergence, and it strikes me that that has something to do with there's a statement in this that this is no big deal. This is just who I am.
Uh-huh.
Do you see another step there toward saying this is the world we ought to be living in?
Certainly, because the implication with this is who I am is if you object to who I am, then you are prejudiced. There's not room for saying you have a moral objection or you have a religious objection based on your worldview. You either accept homosexuality as being normal or you suffer from some form of bigotry. There's no room in between.
Tell us the story of Rosie O'Donnell. What is she trying to achieve in Florida in particular?
Well, in essence, she is, of course, trying to overturn Florida's adoption restrictions. And as I pointed out in my article, she's formidable because she's likable. I have always liked Rosie O'Donnell. At least everything I've seen of her, every movie I've seen her in and when I've seen her on TV, I just found her to be earthy and funny and a very, very good, likable entertainer. And so I think what she did, Todd, is she reached a point where she realized she could use her status to further a cause that she deeply believes in. And I will give gay and lesbian leadership this much, Todd. They truly believe in and are committed to what they are doing. And that's part of the key to their success. I find them much more committed than most conservatives and even most Christians when it comes to social matters. So she's, in essence, trying to overturn Florida adoption laws. As it stands now in the state of Florida, she can serve as a sort of a guardian temporarily, but she cannot serve as an adoptive parent. So she can foster parent kids, anyone can in Florida, but not permanently adopt them. And she is saying that the only reason she's not able to permanently adopt is because she is lesbian, which is true. And she is trying to get that overturned because, and here's her basic premise, there is no difference, essentially, between a homosexual and a heterosexual couple. Provided that both homosexual people and heterosexual people care about and love the children, then one home is just as good as another. So she's basically trying to blur the distinction between the two.
And what arguments is she relying on in order to make the case?
Well, she relies largely, I think, on the arguments of silence, Todd. She's in essence saying, well, prove to me that as a lesbian I am less capable of raising a child than if I were heterosexual. Provide me with proof that adoption would harm these children. Now, here we're in a bit of catch-22 because, of course, gay adoption, gay parenting, even gay marriage, I mean, this is all relatively new stuff, so there's no body of evidence to fall back on to necessarily prove our case, even though I think we have a very strong case. But her argument is primarily one of silence, in which she says, look, I have the money to take care of a child, I'm a nice person, and I live a clean lifestyle, therefore it would be in the child's best interest to be raised with me, and there would be no harm inflicted on the child.
I have heard that she cites some figures about the percentage of the U.S. population, population of humans in general, and homosexuality.
Yes, she does rely largely on the argument that if a certain percentage of every race is homosexual, then homosexuality must be normal. Of course, again, you remember how I said that the arguments lie primarily on their emotional appeal, not on their logic, because there's a certain percentage of the human race that has any number of faults and problems. We would never normalize those problems just because a certain percentage of the race suffers from them. There will always be a percentage of the race that is violent, that lies, that commits any number of immoral acts. We would never say that those acts are acceptable just because a percentage engages in them. So that really is a kind of a circular logic that doesn't really hold up well.
If homosexuality is unnatural, then does it necessarily mean that homosexuals can't be good parents?
No, it does not, Todd. It doesn't. And I think that on this end, conservatives and especially Christian conservatives have gone the other extreme and even lost credibility. Many Christians to this day, for example, believe that if Rosie or another homosexual person were to adopt children, that they would molest them. Well, that is not true. Many people believe that a homosexual who adopted children would be raising them in an environment where obscene behavior is regularly displayed. That's not true. Of course, Rosie or another homosexual could be a reasonably good parent. The question is not whether they could be good or horrible, but rather which is better suited to the interest of a child. A child is, and I do think statistics and studies bear this out, better off raised in a home with two parents of complementary gender. Now, that is a fact that homosexual couples cannot get around, no matter how good they are. The same could be said of single parenting. Of course, there are mothers and fathers who are single parents who raise their children fairly well. But a single parent home is not as productive and as much in the child's best interest as a two-parent home. That's a fact that single parents can't get around. That's reality.
There is an argument that you are employing here, and I want to bring it out so that we can kind of see it for what it is on the table, and that is, and you call this in your article, created intent. Tell us about it.
Created intent. Well, that I think most of the culture wars we see, Todd, are being fought between people who either believe in created intent or who believe that ethics should be informed by our subjective experience. Those of us who believe in created intent, such as Christians and Jews and people of other faiths, we believe that we are created beings and that our responsibility in life is to determine what our Creator has intended for us. That is created intent. For that reason, those of us who are Christians and conservative Jewish people as well, we believe that the Bible clearly spells out a plan for sexuality that is limited to sexual relations between a man and a woman in the covenant of marriage for many different reasons. And for that reason, we believe that created intent is in the best interest of all people. Now, people who believe in a more subjective ethic basically say, what seems natural to me is therefore natural. So if homosexuality seems natural to me, it's natural. If I say that my unborn child is a choice, not a child, then it is therefore a choice. It's basically a way of saying what seems right and natural to me determines my ethical position.
Another thing you point out in the article is kind of an underhanded technique that is used. It's a rhetorical technique, really, that's used for those arguing for gay adoption, and that is what you call worst case and best case comparisons.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, a worst case, best case comparison basically takes the product you're trying to push and compares it to the worst case scenario of the opposing product. So in the case of gay adoption, the worst case, best case scenario says, you know what, Rosie and her female partner live in a very well-appointed estate in Florida. She's very successful. They could provide very well for their children. And they're nice people. I mean, they're not doing drugs. They're not involved in criminal activity. If you compare being raised by she and her female partner to, say, what it would be like being raised in a ghetto where drugs and violence are daily occurrences and where the parents routinely beat the child and where there's no money and children are starving, well, of course, they would be better off being raised by Rosie and by her partner in an environment with two lesbian parents rather than in that violent, crime-infested ghetto. But again, a best-case, worst-case scenario is not a realistic way to determine what's in the best interest of the child altogether. What's in the best interest of the child altogether is to be raised in a safe home without drugs and violence, with ample income, and by a man and a woman who can provide the child with what each gender uniquely brings into the family and which the other gender cannot supply.
There is a concern that I have, kind of a practical concern when it comes to gay adoption, and that has to do with, I think it can be statistically shown that gay couples do not tend to have long-term monogamous relationships to the same degree that heterosexual couples, especially those who are married, do. Is there any truth to this belief on my part, and is that a legitimate concern?
Well, yes to both, Todd. First, of course, there's truth to that belief, and that truth is backed up by every study done comparing the longevity of a homosexual relationship to the longevity of heterosexual relationships. Let me be very quick to say, heterosexuals have not done a bang-up job displaying normality and longevity. We have a high divorce rate. There are horrible crimes committed by heterosexuals against their own children. The headlines are full of them. And so heterosexuality doesn't automatically mean normal and good. But the reality, of course, is that couples of the opposite sex tend to stay together longer. And by the way, Todd, I was myself actively involved with the gay community for about 6 years back in the late 70s, early 80s, and had many homosexual relationships myself and knew many gay and lesbian couples. And no, the longevity just wasn't there. Now, many gay people would say, well, the reason we don't stay together is because you won't let us get married. But, you know, history has shown that a lot of the reasons they give for pathological behavior get shot down when those reasons are removed. A good example is the homophobia argument. When the AIDS epidemic first hit in the early 80s, many gay people said the reason they were still having sex with each other, even though they knew it was risky, was because society forced them into these lonely ghettos where they only had each other. Well, now, in the 20-odd years since then, there's been a much more open acceptance of homosexuality, and yet we still see a high incidence of AIDS infection among openly gay men. And I suspect the same would be true in gay marriage, even if we allowed for gay marriage in this country, which I hope we don't, but frankly, I think there's a good chance we will, Todd. If we do, I think what we will see is that the marriage license is not going to keep gay couples together.
Now, I have heard recently, and I can't remember who I interviewed or what, where the article appeared, I've heard recently about a renewal of promiscuity in the gay community, of bathhouse behavior, things like this, even in the face of the what is still an overwhelming epidemic of AIDS.
Scary beyond belief. And Todd, again, when AIDS first hit, the enemy was homophobia, the Reagan administration, the moral majority, all the people who said homosexuality was wrong. We were oppressing them, and therefore they behaved in self-destructive ways. Well, you know what? The moral majority is no longer with us. Reagan is not president. The country has gone to a very broad acceptance of homosexuality. And where you see these high incidents of AIDS infection, Todd, you see them in major metropolitan areas where you can walk down the street holding your gay lover's hand and find a good deal of affirmation. So that argument just doesn't hold up anymore. There is still an epidemic. The behavior is still risky. Something is fundamentally wrong with this picture.
Is it your contention, as someone who was involved in the gay lifestyle and to come out of it, that homosexuality, at least as it is a phenomenon in Western culture and American culture, is essentially promiscuous?
Not quite. I think among men, yes, because I think, unfortunately, men, if they are left unbridled, tend to be very promiscuous. I knew many lesbians who tended not to be promiscuous. They tended to be much more into the longevity of a relationship and much more moderate in their lifestyles. But I think part of the problem of homosexuality is that men inherently, I think, need the restraining influence of a female spouse that keeps the man roped within God-ordained boundaries and keeps him more as a provider and more within the nest. I think if you leave man unbridled, he will often be very promiscuous. Now, if you combine men with men and have virtually no restrictions, my gosh, you've got something very explosive. And that's why I believe AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases flow so quickly and easily through the homosexual male population, because I think that, unfortunately, promiscuity is a largely male phenomenon. And when you have men together, of course, that that phenomenon just explodes.
Someone goes to work tomorrow and around the water cooler, around the copy machine, who knows. A colleague says, I think gays should be allowed to adopt. I think it's better to have gay parents than for them to live in an orphanage or in foster care. Your response?
Well, of course, it would be better for children to get out of orphanages and foster care, but why should we settle for something less than a standard which would be in those children's best interest? If I was at that water cooler, I'd say, you know what? I know so many gay men and lesbian women who are wonderful people, and I agree with you in so many ways. They are good citizens, and they are likable, and they definitely contribute significantly to our culture, and I respect that. But as parents, no. I would draw the line there, and I would draw the line because a man and a man, or a woman and a woman, can never offer to a child what a woman and a man can offer together.
Will Rosie O'Donnell and those who join her in the push for gay adoption, will they be successful? How do you think this is going to come out?
I'm not optimistic, Todd. Unfortunately, I think that we're not fighting this battle very successfully for more reasons than I think we can get into on this show. So I believe, barring a miracle, that if current trends continue, we'll see a much broader acceptance of gay adoption in America and probably an overturning of legal restrictions. I don't think it's an unwinnable fight, but my experience so far has been that the people who propose normalizing homosexuality show more stamina in the long run than the people who oppose it.
Very briefly, will that lead then, do you think, to a normalization of same-sex unions? Because the two seem to go hand in hand. If they've got kids in the house, then maybe they ought to have some more stable kind of a legally recognized union there.
My belief, again, is not hopeful, but I don't want to be optimistic just for the sake of optimism. If trends keep continuing, the American public is showing more and more a willingness to accept homosexuality as a viable option. If public opinion can be molded to believe that a man like Will in Will and Grace, a likable, handsome, professional guy, is just the same, essentially, as any heterosexual, then eventually the public is going to say, well, why shouldn't they have the right to marry? Why shouldn't they have the right to adopt? Why shouldn't we recognize their relationships as being normal? So unless there is a real shifting in our cultural trends, yes, I do believe we'll see the normalization of same-sex unions in America.
Joe Dallas, thank you for being our guest.
Todd, thank you for having me.
Joe Dallas is founder of Genesis Counseling, based in Tustin, California, author of the books Desires in Conflict and A Strong Delusion. He's written an article in a recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled, What About Rosie? You can also visit the website for Genesis Counseling. The address is very simple, Genesis Counseling, all one word, genesiscounseling.org. That's genesiscounseling.org. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear from President George W. Bush, some excerpts from his State of the Union address last night. If you heard it, your reaction, that's what I'm looking for, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And if you didn't hear it, we'll have it for you when we come back, at least in excerpts.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
When the disciples asked Jesus to teach them to pray, Jesus gave them the Lord's Prayer. Is spontaneous prayer more spiritual than the Lord's Prayer? Is the Lord's Prayer the perfect prayer? If you're asking these questions, you'll find answers in a new book called To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. It's the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. You can order To All Eternity online. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find a link to Concordia Publishing House. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House Monday through Friday during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Order our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
The curse of Ham. It's not true. Answers with Ken Ham, host of the popular film The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, I've heard many Christians claim that Ham was cursed because of what he did to his father Noah, but you're saying this isn't really true.
Well, sadly, I've also heard many Christians say that the curse of Ham resulted in people with black skin. Some religions, including the Mormons, used to teach this. But if you read the Bible carefully, we find that Ham was not cursed. It was his son, Canaan. And this had nothing whatsoever to do with black skin. For a start, everyone has the same skin color anyway. It's just a matter of how much or how little of the pigment melanin we have in our skin. Secondly, most of the descendants of Canaan were wiped out. Such people included the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. Personally, I think the reason Canaan was cursed was because Noah saw in his grandson the same disrespectful and rebellious attitude he saw in his son Ham, only it was much worse. Noah knew what sort of people Canaan's descendants would be. This should be a warning to all of us, particularly fathers, to train our children in the ways of the Lord and not to turn out a Canaan.
The Bible has much to teach us about the origins of the different groups of people. It also gives us the cure for racism. Find out how when you read Ken Ham's powerful booklet on the origin of so-called races. For some fascinating reading, go to AnswersRadio.com. You can read Ken Ham's free booklet right on your computer screen or download it and print it out.
AM 850 KFUO. Up next on Issues Etc., open lines for your telephone calls and your comments. Right here on AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis, overnight partly cloudy, low of about 20, and for Tuesday, mostly sunny and a high near 42. Right now, overcast and 28 in St. Louis. Our last look at St. Louis traffic. Southbound 270 is heavy in pockets from Manchester to Doherty Ferry. Northbound 270 between Page and Dorset, there's some heavy traffic in the right lane there. Also exiting onto 70, that's heavy. Westbound 40 slows Hampton to Hanley and Brentwood to 270. Westbound 70 at Cypress, slow traffic, and in pockets from Earth City to 94. Eastbound 40 between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge, there's some stop-and-go traffic there. And northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. Ephesians 6:16 says, "Take up the shield of faith with which you will be able to extinguish all the flaming missiles of the evil one." Did you know Satan is firing flaming missiles at you and your family every day? Families need the gospel, God's word, prayer, and to be strong in the Lord and the strength of His might. Join us next time.
Saturday morning at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Claim to know all the ways of providence, yet we can trust in them, placing our confidence in the loving God behind all of life and all of history. May He guide us now, and may God continue to bless the United States of America.
That was the conclusion of George W. Bush's State of the Union address last night. I did not have an opportunity to see the State of the Union. I was putting my kids to bed. I listened to a bit of it on the radio, and then I watched the majority of it, I would say, probably in review through the news channels, and read the entire thing this morning via the internet. I want to know what you think about the President's State of the Union address last night. I went online, and it was, I think, Washington Post, they had a little poll. What did you make of the President's address? So I always take these little polls online because you get to view the results instantly. Well, out of about 10,000 people who had voted this morning at the Washington Post, it was interesting. The top one was like, hit a home run. The second one was pretty good. The next one was so-so. And the last one was something along the lines of, it was a real dud, didn't move me at all. It was equally split when I voted between all four of those. Each one had 24%, and then there was like 1% or something that said, don't know. If you don't know, I don't know why you take the poll, but people do. equally split. What did you think of the president's speech last night? It's open lines for the remainder of the program today for the next 25 minutes. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's hear more from the president. Here's President George W. Bush urging Congress to pass his faith-based initiatives plan.
I urge you to pass both my faith-based initiative and the Citizen Service Act to encourage acts of compassion that can transform America one heart and one soul at a time.
And the president continued to make a plea for government support of faith-based programs.
Americans are doing the work of compassion every day, visiting prisoners, providing shelter for battered women, bringing companionship to lonely seniors. These good works deserve our praise, they deserve our personal support, and when appropriate, they deserve the assistance of the federal government.
Now, if you saw the speech last night, you might have noted it had a two-part form, basically. Domestic, international. The United States, Iraq. Those are the two parts of this speech. This all fits within the domestic plan. He is very bold about his faith-based initiatives. He is pushing, one would say, that there are a lot of things that a president has to sort through. What am I going to leave in? What am I going to leave out when I'm writing the State of the Union address? It goes through probably, I would guess, dozens of drafts before it finally gets into its form that the president tries to commit to memory and brings before the joint houses of Congress. I often wonder what was left out, what was left in. A lot of time devoted to faith-based initiatives. A lot of time devoted to Iraq. It came 40 minutes into the speech, but if you read the speech, it's about halfway through that speech. Those are obviously big issues. Was there something there that you think the president missed talking about that should have been in? This is considered by many a crucial State of the Union address for this president, because if you will remember, the last State of the Union address, the first one he made as president last year, was made right after September 11th. He addressed the joint houses of Congress right after September 11th, and then he had his State of the Union address, and things were still very much in flux in our country. He was, in a lot of ways, holding America's hand last year. Now, public mood has changed a little bit. Some people are calling this his first State of the Union address because they say, well, the last one really didn't count as a State of the Union. What did you think about it? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you watched it, did you watch it waiting for him to say something that you didn't hear him say? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Finally, President Bush told the story about a man treated for his drug addiction by the Healing Place Church in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
A man in the program said, God does miracles in people's lives, and you never think it could be you. Tonight, let us bring to all Americans who struggle with drug addiction this message of hope. The miracle of recovery is possible, and it could be you.
Now, we don't have sound for this, but the president immediately went on to say this. By caring for children who need mentors, for addicted men and women who need treatment, we are building a more welcoming society, a culture that values every life. And in this work, we must not overlook the weakest among us. I ask you to protect infants at the very hour of birth and end the practice of partial birth abortion. And because no human life should be started or ended as the object of an experiment, I ask you to set a high standard for humanity and pass a law against all human cloning. Tell me what you thought about the president's speech last night. I was waiting for those words that I just read for you. Those are the two big agenda items before the Senate right now that the president has vowed he will sign on the issue of life. What were you waiting for that you may not have heard? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think he spent enough time talking about the life issue? One paragraph, really the last half of one paragraph. Using the criteria that we told you about yesterday in our interview with Dr. John Johnson, when we talked about just war, do you think that the president made the case for the preemptive strike upon Iraq as just war. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. You know, it just occurred to me, listening to that sound of the president, why I like this president. And it's a subliminal thing. He sounds exactly like my pastor. The two, their voices are almost indistinguishable. I didn't realize that until I suddenly, this guy sounds just like Pastor Smith. Doing. Maybe they're distantly related. Who knows? They're both from Texas. It's a good place to be from. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Were you expecting more from him in the issue of life? And do you think he made the case justifying war with Iraq? Jim joins us from Fairmount City. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Very, very well, Jim.
Thanks. I listened to him quite a bit last night, and I was kind of expecting to hear him say something about how he was going to fix the economy, but I never did hear that. But the only thing I heard was is how he's going to give our money away to all the nations in the world because of HIV and all this kind
of
stuff.
Now, that was a big part of the speech, and it was unexpected. This was
Absolutely.
One of the things that had people going, what? Because he said he's going to triple the amount of money going to African countries to help fight the AIDS epidemic on the continent. And there were people who had expected him to say something about this. But he, if you want to, you know, view these issues as kind of centerpieces, this was pretty near the center of the table in that speech. So did you have a problem with that, Jim?
Me? Yeah, I've got a problem with it. I think you ought to bring our money home and sell.
Jim, thank you very much. You got Craig agreeing with you over here in the studio. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. He did talk about improving the economy, by the way. One of the big taglines in the entire speech, the one that was played all morning, at least to the radio stations I was listening, had to do with the best way to stimulate the economy is to have people have more money to spend, and the best way to make sure people have that money to spend and stimulate the economy is not to tax it away from them in the first place. And there was this huge round of applause, which at least the news reported came almost exclusively from the Republican side of the aisle. What did you think of the president's speech? Was it a great speech? I have heard speeches in my life from presidents that I deem to be great speeches. Many of you will completely disagree with this, but I think one of the greatest speeches delivered by a president in my lifetime was the Thousand Points of Light speech that was made by President Bush the first time around, his dad. And many people made fun of that speech. I thought it was one of the most brilliant speeches made. No pun intended. Was it so-so? Were you disappointed? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. I watched the entire speech, and I'd like to comment not so much on the content, but on the manner in which it was delivered. If Bush was using a teleprompter, I couldn't tell it. It seems that he had memorized or just was speaking off the cuff. It was an excellent delivery. And it showed a man who was sincere and knew what he was talking about, was on the level with the American people. He came across as a great leader. I was observing also the faces of some of the opposition party. Mr. Daschle looked very displeased and sour grapes about the whole thing. Today's Post editorial cartoon is very juvenile.
I haven't seen it. What does it show?
It shows not everybody, but most editorial cartoonists portray Bush as a chimpanzee. And behind him, where Vice President Cheney was sitting, is a rich man with dollar bills coming out of his vest pockets and everything. And where Dennis Hastert was sitting, it was Dr. Strangelove, of all people. It was just a very juvenile ad hominem attack upon Bush. But getting back to my point, Bush delivered an excellent speech. The points were pertinent. I can't see anything to fault the man on the subjects he presented. I think he displayed ample gravitas. If you remember how the Democrats played that word back and forth ad nauseum.
Well, I agree with you there. I will before I let you go, I will need to know, do you think he made the case for justifying a war with Iraq? In other words, based upon just war theory, do you think he made the case?
Let me preface it by saying this. I'm not sure how God feels about going into war. I'm wondering how I stand with him, because I want to see it happen.
Okay.
When the bombs start dropping and the shooting, I know it's going to give me a surge of adrenaline, and I don't know if that's right or not.
Well, the question of just war doesn't really ask what does God think about it, because all war is obviously deplorable to God. The question is, can it be the lesser of two evils? Can it be a necessary evil? Do you think he made that case, that this is a necessary evil?
I do. I think that Saddam Hussein, if left to his own devices, will perpetrate even greater atrocities on not only his own people, the region, but ultimately the United States of America, not to mention France and Germany.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. By the way, he was using a teleprompter. No president would dare step into that chamber without the speech completely in front of him, 7 Ways to Sunday. He had the speech in front of him. He had the teleprompter. The teleprompters had backup teleprompters. There was probably an aide standing by with an extra copy of the speech in case he sneezed it off the podium. They are ready to go when they do this, because it's important stuff. Although I will say this, the president was faulted early in the campaign for not being able to use the teleprompter and getting his words wrong. He still gets his words wrong. He mispronounces nuclear every time he says it. At least he's consistent. But he's learned to use the teleprompter. What struck me, the most, these speeches are often punctuated about every 30 seconds with an applause line. They allow time for applause, and they know which ones are going to get the applause. It's the way the speech is written. It's written with a cadence, with a rhythm. Good speech writers will tell you this, a cadence and a rhythm that allows for a change of mood, that allows for a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that allows for the big applause lines. When he was talking about what happens in Iraq and what Saddam Hussein has not destroyed or given evidence that he has destroyed by way of weapons of mass destruction, no applause lines. It was dead silence. You would have thought he was addressing an empty room. It was very rhetorically, by way of just speech making, it was a very powerful moment. Did he leave out the right things? Did he leave the right things in? What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have 10 more minutes left in open lines, issues, etc. for your phone calls. We played the ending at the beginning, and I would like to read that for you one more time so that, and this is boilerplate presidential talk. It is. Every president comes to the end of a big speech like this and invokes the deity. Well, I'll begin a few paragraphs up. He says, America is a strong nation and honorable in use of our strength. We exercise power without conquest and sacrifice for liberty of strangers. Americans are free people who know that freedom is a right of every person and the future of every nation. The liberty we prize is not America's gift to the world. It is God's gift to humanity. We Americans have faith in ourselves, but not in ourselves alone. We do not claim to know all the ways of providence, yet we can trust in them, placing our confidence in the loving God behind all life and all history. May he guide us now. May he continue to bless us, the United States of America. I'd like to append my previous statement. That goes a little bit beyond the standard presidential boilerplate, which is God bless you all and God bless America. Or may God guide us in this endeavor or something like this. While he refers to God in terms of divine providence, he does talk about a God that is behind all life and all history. Now, that does not qualify as making this a Christian statement, because it is still too generic. Had he been any more specific than that, I'm sure he would have been completely taken to the woodshed by the press the next day. They'll allow this much. Providence, God, loving God, guiding history, fine. Not too specific. Now, I tended to hear those words and welcome them when I heard them. But if I'm honest with you, I remember the previous president, when he invoked God, deity, and often as he did, the previous president
President Bill Clinton quoted scripture, and very often quoted scripture, in speeches and in State of the Union addresses. I was always nervous. Not maybe nervous, annoyed. What about you? You notice that little discrepancy when it's a president that you, I'll speak only for myself. When it's a president that I trust and I support his general viewpoint, he can mention God all he wants, but when it's a president that I don't trust and I don't support his politics, I don't like it when he quotes the Bible or mentions God. Is that you too? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Picking up on something we were talking about just a few minutes ago with Joe Dallas. Well, this is a related story, in fact. We were talking about gay adoption, same-sex unions. This is from the Associated Press this week. A federal fund created to compensate victims of the September 11th attacks has awarded $500,000 to the lesbian partner of a woman who died at the Pentagon, a decision gay rights advocates hailed as a milestone. You bet it's a milestone. It's symbolic, but it's a milestone. Sheila Hine, 51, a civilian army management analyst who died when a hijacked American Airlines jet slammed into the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia, was wearing a gold band given to her by Peggy Neff, her partner of 18 years. Another emerald ring that had been a gift from Neff was missing from Hine's remains. It had been pulverized, Neff wrote in an affidavit filed with her federal claim. She was my entire world and my soulmate, my closest confidant, and my best friend, Neff added. Under Virginia laws, Neff was not eligible for state aid. But the head of a Department of Justice fund established after the attacks concluded that Neff was entitled to compensation. Kenneth Feinberg, special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund, wrote on November 26th that Neff had accepted $557,390 from the fund. The letter, released this week by Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which represents Neff, was first reported by the Washington Post. Neff's lawyers called the decision a huge step forward for the federal government. It was unclear whether the decision set a precedent for other partners of those who died in the attacks. I wonder about that too, don't you? We cannot pretend that things aren't as they are. They are this. There is only one state in the union that recognizes same-sex unions and gives these kind of compensatory payments to same-sex partners of these unions by law. That's Vermont. It's the only state that does it. All the other states, well, they may do it in the future, but who knows? They don't do it now. There is no legal entity in the other 49 states called same-sex unions. There may be informal entities, they may be people having wishful thinking, but they don't exist in these 49 states. Now, given the fact that there is no legal relationship between Neff and the woman who passed away in the Pentagon, her lesbian partner, no, in Virginia, in any other state besides Vermont, no legal relationship, period. And yet money was awarded to her as a survivor, as would have been awarded to a surviving wife or husband. What is to stop anyone who was simply just living, heterosexual couple, simply living with someone who died at the Pentagon from coming forward now and saying, where's my $557,000? You see, this has ramifications beyond just same-sex unions. If two people in a relationship, regardless of their sexual orientation, as it is called, a relationship that is purely informal, that is, there is no legal recognition of it, as are homosexual relationships, no matter how long they've been going on in the state of Virginia, if the survivor in that couple can be awarded this kind of compensation after a tragedy like this, the death of their partner, then I see no real reason why, let's say one of the pool secretaries at the Pentagon was simply, her boyfriend had just moved in to her apartment. She'd given him the key, he'd moved in, he'd moved his stereo and his stuff over. They were living together. They were committed to one another. She might say, or he might say of her after she is killed at the Pentagon, she was my whole life, my whole reason for existence, my best friend, my confidant. Give me my $557,000. And I imagine that the fund would say, no, that doesn't qualify. Don't you imagine they would say the same thing? Yes, this is a precedent. This is a bad precedent. Not only because it would serve as a symbolic step forward to accepting same-sex unions. Not a legal step forward, but a symbolic step forward for accepting same-sex unions, but also a symbolic step forward for accepting all other forms of union as well. You see, once you open the door and redefine marriage or union, legal union between two people, from what it is in common law, in common sense, been established to be a man and a woman, adults, once the door is open to other definitions, you cannot exclude any definition. Woman and woman, man and man, two heterosexuals who just happen to be living together, those are all common enough. What about a man and a girl? I'm talking about a minor girl. What about a man and his dog? What if someone's dog died there? And he says, he was my whole life, he was my confidant, he was my best friend. Give me my $557,000. Because once you redefine marriage, you can't stop redefining it. Something to chew on over the evening. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our reaction to President George W. Bush's State of the Union address when we welcome to our microphones Congressman John Shimkus of Illinois. We'll also get a biblical definition of love. Dr. Jeff Gibbs of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis will be our guest. Let me take this time here as January winds down to tell you one more time about our January Issues Etc. book of the month. It's called To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. Why don't you order it tonight when you go online and check your email? Go to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. There you're going to find information on this Issues Etc. book of the month for January to all eternity. You can also call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask to receive the Issues Etc. book of the month. It's called To All Eternity. The phone number again, call during regular business hours. This is the number for Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Or as I said, go online. When you get home, when you check your email, when you do your browsing, browse to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and there you're going to find information on how to order our Issues Etc. book of the month for January, To All Eternity, The Essential Teachings of Christianity. Everyone who's ordered it has loved it. It's worth your time. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.